We left off where Daniel was promoted and his three friends recognized as well after Daniel revealed and interpreted this dream of the king Nebuchadnezzar, who was wondering what will happen after he goes, what's going to happen. And Daniel interpreting this dream, this image in the dream, this multi-metallic image of gold and silver and bronze and iron and clay, essentially outlines world history way in advance, hundreds of years before those events took place, to details. And so now in this chapter, we record some years after. We don't know how much time it was, but ultimately, though Nebuchadnezzar was greatly impressed by Daniel and his God, he is now going to be lifted up in pride. We know that because he is going to erect an image, possibly the image he saw in his dream. However, instead of it being multi-metallic, it will be all gold. As a pretty much an arrogant statement to say, listen, I'm not going to stop. I'm going to rule forever. My kingdom will go on forever. And he sets in motion this construction of this image, and there are those friends of Daniel who are present who refuse to acknowledge it as he causes the whole world to bow down to this image. They say no. They're brought before the king. They're faced with a threat. It's either bow or be thrown into the furnace. And they have what I would call furnace faith. They say, no way, king. You know, if that's the choice, we don't even need to answer. We're not going to bow before the image. So they get thrown into the fire, and God miraculously preserves them. So the whole story is one of those stories that essentially has been immortalized for generations. But it's more than just a story, folks. It's a historical event. And it is just one of those places where God intervenes in history in a very dramatic way because he's doing something quite different. Now, for most of us, we won't be faced with such choices to actually be thrown into a burning furnace. But there are other furnaces that we face. There are other pressures to not obey God, to deny God, or sin against God. We're not pressured by necessarily being threatened with our lives, but we might be pressured with just the internal temptation for sin, or pressured with the political correctness of this world to not say that Jesus is unique. He is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but through him. We will be pressured in this, and folks, the oven is getting heated up in our society more and more. So we need to see the type of faith that we need to encounter this political correct world and to know what God has for us. And as we stand like these three Jewish men against the tide, we might just discover how God will show his power to through us. Let's take a look. Verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king. He made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. And of course, that cubit would be, if you're unfamiliar, it's just a sense of it's the distance between the tip of your finger and your elbow. And since everyone's arm varies, it averaged around 18 inches. So this is about a 90 foot tall image by 9 foot, which would be essentially a 10-to-1 ratio, which would make it kind of weird, actually. Most people's bodies are 4.5, 3, 5 even to 1, but not 10 to 1. That would be a very long, skinny, kind of a weird look. But maybe he was looking for height rather than width because he wanted to raise it up so that people could see it from a distance being out there in the plain. Because he sets it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon, probably some distance, maybe a few miles out. We don't know exactly where that is. But it would have been something that when the sun hit it, you know, when you're driving up the turnpike on a sunny day, and that sun is hitting the little top of the Statue of Liberty, which is actually taller, about 150 foot tall, actually 305 foot with the base, so it's way up there. You can get this picture of just the gleaming gold. Well, this was all gold. Now, whether it was solid gold, covered with gold, don't know. The point is, he's setting this image. Now, this is where it gets interesting. The king, verse 2, sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, governors, counselors, treasurers, judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Nebuchadnezzar, he's inviting all of these guys out. And then so it says in verse 3, the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors. The reason there's such repetition is because this is kind of a legalese language. You know, that essentially these are official documents. He's just recording. So all of these guys are gathered for the dedication of the image he set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So essentially it's a big dedication party. Hey, we're getting off work for a while. We're going to go out there, have a feast, have a party. Great time. This is awesome. There's a lot of excitement in the air. The image is complete. They'd anticipated it. They'd watched it go up. So now it's the big dedication party. So a herald cried aloud. To you, it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, lyre, psaltery, and in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that the king Nebuchadnezzar has set up. So now the scenario is, to all peoples, to the whole known world, the word has gone out. When you hear this music, from these instruments in this particular song or whatever that they were going to express in symphony, then you are to bow down and worship this image. Now, is this language, to those of you who are familiar with the Bible, a little familiar with some things in Revelation? You might note, here is a world leader enacting a world religion to all peoples, nations, and languages. That phrase is repeated four times in Revelation. You have the threat, verse 6, whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace, and whoever does not receive the mark of the beast in all the world to worship the beast will not be able to buy or sell, the pressure. So you have a very interesting comparison. It seems that in history, you've had these attempts to bring the world together as one, and to compel them with one world government, one world religion, and folks, we are moving in that direction. Now, scholars who want to discredit the Bible will try to point out that there are three Greek words used for these instruments that show that in their minds a later date for this book than Daniel claims. And of course, that has been debunked very easily because they found these same Greek instruments listed in other Babylonian writings. They found that date way back into the 6th century BC. So that claim is, again, like all the critics' claims, false. That this does not prove this was written later. And notice that this threat, whoever does not fall down and worship, see, there's a few things. First of all, this immense amount of gold would have definitely required the period during Nebuchadnezzar's reign. The Babylonian measurement of 60 and 6 shows that it was Babylonian, not Greek, which is based on tens, and our system is based on tens. So you have all of these proofs that this was written in that era. But let's not fuss with some of the critics' points here. Let's not lose sight of what's going on here. Whoever doesn't fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Probably some giant kiln there that was set up to prepare the metals for this great statue. And Nebuchadnezzar coming by, seeing the furnace, thought, that'd be kind of good. Let's hold on to that. It might have other uses for that. Because he liked to cut people in pieces or throw them in the fire, one of the two. That seemed to be his mode. And that the king actually burned people in the fire is actually proved in Jeremiah 29, verse 22. It says that part of the curse upon those who would rebel against the Lord is that the Lord would make them like Zedekiah and Ahab, whom the king of Babylon roasted in the fire. So whoever this unfortunate Zedekiah and Ahab were, they got cooked in the fire. And now he's threatening anyone to be thrown into the fire if they don't fall in line with this worship. Nebuchadnezzar is saying something like this. You know that dream I had? He's saying that the idea of the gold, me being replaced by silver and bronze and iron, well, you know, I got to tell you, it's not going to happen that way, baby. It's all gold. So he's essentially saying, I am not going to stop. I am going to continue on and be dominant. Our kingdom will never end. Particularly, I'm not worried about that stone that came up and destroyed the whole image. You know, that stone might have been able to break the iron and the clay, but it won't be able to break gold. I'm going to change history. I'm not going to stop. I'm going to dominate. Instead of being thankful for being the head and not the toe, he wants it all. Who's ruling, Nebuchadnezzar or God, is the question. And it's a question, I think, in our lives. What influences us the most? Is it Babylon, the society of men, or is it God? Who motivates our decisions in our lives for social interaction? What is it? Is it the pressures of the world or is it God? What motivates our buying and selling? Is it the pressures of what the world tells us or is it God? You see, this is a question we're all going to face. Who's really ruling here? And that's the question. Nebuchadnezzar essentially says, I'm in charge. I don't need God. So verse 7 says, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, it's going to be repeated quite a few times, in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which the king Nebuchadnezzar had set up. That same thing will happen in Revelation as the beast, the Antichrist, will make this image of the beast, and he will cause all the great and the small to worship it. So you have the same mentality here. It's amazing how everybody's doing it. Everybody but. Verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward, these wise men, and accused the Jews. So these other wise men are determined to get their revenge on these three Jewish men. So they rat on them. You know, it's amazing when I see this. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. To you, O king, you've made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. I'm amazed at this. It is the pressure of the world system to control, and there are those who want to get a position, and it doesn't matter if it's on the ruins of others. They're going to rat on those that don't fall in line. Particularly, I think it's an envy thing, so common among the baser sorts. But don't ever underestimate the power of envy in your own life, what it causes you to do and to be. You know, of all things that the Bible, when it describes love, there is the description of what love is. Love is patient and kind. Then there's the description of what love is not. First on the list, love is not envious. Love does not envy. See, I think that when we think about what love is, you're thinking of others. You're not thinking of yourself. Envy is the opposite. You're thinking of yourself. Someone else got something you didn't get. You want that. And this is what is wrong with the world. Envy is a very powerful thing. It's the sin that caused the brothers of Joseph to sell him as a slave. They were envious of him and the father's love that he had for Joseph. It's the sin that almost killed David, as Saul was envious over David as he heard the song. Saul has slain his thousands, but David has tens of thousands and brooded over that thought. How come they're ascribing me only thousands and him tens of thousands? So he sought to kill David. Envy is the sin that is at the root of so much unrest in the world. The haves and the have-nots, the battle. Those that want, they're willing to do whatever it takes to get. It's the very sin that actually the Bible tells us lifted up Jesus on the cross. Do you know that Pilate, when they delivered Jesus to him, he knew, the Bible records, that it was because of envy that they delivered Jesus up, these leaders of the Jews? And they even said it in their council meeting. Caiaphas says, we've got to do something with this guy or we'll lose our place in the nation. It was all envy. So here are these guys, envy. So they rat on them, and these three young men are now put on the spot. Now, there actually is an archaeological find with the names of three officials on a five-sided clay prism there that they found in Iraq, which is ancient Babylon, with these names on it. Hananunu, Mishael Marduk, and Abu Nibu. And they're eerily similar to Hananiah, Mishael, and of course the Abednego was close to the Abu Nibu with the Babylonian name. Whether these are the same three guys or not, it would appear that it would be a very close bet because these guys were prominent officials mentioned together. And these guys now, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are now on the spot. But imagine this, the convictions of these young men. So Nebuchadnezzar, in a rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up?" Now, first of all, there's something strange going on here. I think about these men that lifted him up. They've accused. The king hears these guys won't bow. He's a king. He can just, like that, take your head off, cut you in pieces, throw you into the fire. But there's something that stalls him here. I think it's when he sees these guys. He knows there's something different about them. He knows they're connected to Daniel. And he makes him pause for a moment and want to give these guys another chance. So he says, "Is it true?" Actually, in the Aramaic, it's like, "Tell me it's not true. Can't be true. I know it's not true. You guys wouldn't do that. You wouldn't rebel against me like that. You're good guys. So listen, I'll give you another chance. If you're ready," verse 15, "at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship this image which I have made, good. If you do that, good. We're cool. We're going to be really good. Because I'll know that these guys falsely accused you, and yeah, I won't buy that. But if you do not worship, you will be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Nebi, why did you have to say that? Who is the God? You're going to find out who that God is. I'm amazed at the bravado of this world leader. But again, pride goes before the fall. He's going to be humbled greatly. But think about the convictions these men had. I mean, come on. Everybody's doing it. Who do you think you are? Are you saying your God is better than our gods? You don't bow down to our gods, but you'll bow down to your God? Who do you think you are? You saying our God's not real? You only your God is real? You know, I'm amazed that in our nation, people are missing this one salient fact. That the state religion is becoming more and more powerful, more and more enforcing. And that state religion of secularism essentially is stating that all religions are the same. Don't be so convinced about yours. You know, as long as you keep it in your little reservation, keep it in your little church buildings, that's fine. But as soon as you come out in the public square, you will bow to the secular humanism. You will bow to this idea of believing everybody's religion is equal. It's what you believe, what I believe, we all believe. It doesn't matter because it's just all about the state, essentially. Even when 9/11 happened, I was amazed at how many religious ceremonies were being conducted by the state. Get this religious guy, let's get a bunch of them together. They're all the same anyway, and let's have our big, you know, memorial. You know, when we did ours, we actually were kind of pushed out of the PNC Arts Center on the Sunday that we wanted to have it because they decided they wanted to do theirs. And then we were pushed on Tuesday. I look at this and I think this is exactly what our founding fathers wanted to prevent, a state religion. Yet this is exactly where we are. But they'll tell you, see, the elite will say to you, "Oh, beware the Christian right. Beware these Christians. They want to make this nation only Christian, and you only can believe in the Christian God." You know, folks, the reason what made America great is because of our Christian heritage, which preserved the freedom of conscience for anyone to worship however they wanted to worship. And that's why people flooded into this nation, because they couldn't do that in other places where the religion was run by the state. You see, Christianity is what preserved, because Christianity by nature requires you to have freedom of conscience. Otherwise, it wouldn't be truly from your heart. What kind of satisfaction do you get out of forcing someone to bow to an image? They might be bowing in their bodies, but their heart isn't there. You haven't influenced them. You haven't won them. But that doesn't matter when it comes to power. But you see, when you believe in Jesus and you say, "I believe what Jesus said, I believe he is the Son of God, that he died for our sins. And apart from him, no one will see God. If you don't have the Son, you don't have the Father." Now, that's what you believe as a Christian. That is considered very intolerant. But if you take anybody's religious belief and they're convinced about it, by nature of being convinced about it, you believe all the others are wrong. If you're a Hare Krishna and you say, "Hare, Hare, you know, Rama, Rama" to Krishna, and you believe that, then that means you do not believe what Jesus did for you on the cross. You do not believe in the Bible. You're rejecting that claim. You're saying that is false. This is the way to worship. So by definition, anyone's religion. It's what they believe. But the state will not allow that kind of intolerance. So essentially, you've got to acknowledge all of the gods as equal, which is essentially what happens in Rome. That's why the Christians were persecuted. It happens here in Babylon, why the Jewish men here are persecuted. So Nebuchadnezzar wants to at least give them a chance. By the way, this is not new. Nebuchadnezzar might have been the prototype, but there have been many who have tried to bring church and state together and force and eventually lead to a place where you acknowledge the man. Hitler, great example. Do you know that in a letter in 1936, on July 29th, by Herr Balder von Schirach, published in the Times of London, he said, "One cannot be a good German, at the same time deny God. But an arousal of faith in the eternal German is at the same time an arousal of faith in God. If we act as true Germans, we act according to the laws of God. Whoever serves Adolf Hitler, the Führer, serves Germany, and whoever serves Germany serves God." See how subtle that was. Just slipping it right in there. You know, you believe in God, we believe in God, the laws of God, God. But German, you know, we are eternally German, honoring God. And of course, the Führer is over German. So to honor the Führer is to honor Germany, is to honor God. And we are headed in the same way for a one world religion one day. But when it all comes down and is judged and the stone hits those 10 toes, I'm not going to be around. Those who believe in the Lord Jesus, I don't believe will be around. I think the Lord is going to remove his bride from the place. One of the reasons I believe that, obviously, is because we're not destined for the wrath of God. When God's wrath is poured out on this world, this godless world, that's his wrath. And the Bible says his people, his bride, is not destined for wrath. But there's also another curious point here. As we're reading this story, you ever wonder, where's Daniel? Where is Daniel? Obviously, we presume he was probably away in some state business somewhere and he wasn't present. Or maybe they never brought accusation to him because they already got beaten up by him once and they don't want to tangle with him again. I don't know. But Daniel's out of the picture here. And I think it's a great type because you have a picture of the tribulation period. The tribulation is the day of Jacob's trouble, Jeremiah 30. That time Jesus spoke about that will come upon the earth. It'll be a time of tremendous cataclysmic events where God is judging the world. But it's a time in which largely the Jewish people who have not acknowledged Jesus as a Messiah will endure. However, they're the type of these three Jewish men is the type of the Jews going through the tribulation. God is going to preserve them because he has not forgotten his covenant with Abraham. And he is faithful to fulfill that. For those Jewish people who have not received Jesus. However, they will come to a huge revival in that time when they will recognize him whom they pierced. However, Daniel, I believe, is a type of his bride who is rescued before the tribulation. Doesn't mean we don't have a tribulation in this world, as many of our brothers and sisters throughout the world are undergoing persecution. And frankly, it is going to get stronger and stronger in this nation. We will see the conformity, the pressure to conform to the state religion more and more. Well, the ENDA right now that our Congress is debating on these discrimination laws, what they're slipping in. They tried to slip in and now they're backing off on it because they realized it was going to be a big stretch. They've already slipped in about homosexuality. You know, you can't discriminate against them, which in one sense is kind of tough. You know, look, you're a Christian. We're going to hire a receptionist. You know, we have receptionists for the school and someone applies to the job who is an avowed open homosexual. And we say, well, no, you can't work here because of your homosexuality. We believe that's a sin. We're all of a sudden we're violating the law. We'll be fined and we'll be pressured to conform. Well, they tried to slip in also cross-dressing. You know, I don't know how you would feel about coming to the school reception to drop off your kids and there's a guy there with half a beard and he's dressed like a woman. You know, I don't know how you'd feel about that. The more and more people are getting brainwashed, the more and more people are thinking, well, you know, I know that is abhorrent to me personally, but I just, you know, I don't think we should judge and we should, you know, folks, what kind of an example are we setting for people? Let's use our brains instead of falling into this political correctness of the world. Well, it's very intolerant and bigoted of you to deny them the right to be how they are. And I say it's much more kind to tell them the truth that that looks ridiculous and he ought to be what he is by God. Well, who are you to say what he is? You know, listen, this is where it gets down into some very difficult areas. You can find the blurring of whatever is a man, a woman, or a man, and some are born with, you know, various, you know, conditions in which that is very blurred. And I understand that. But because there is a condition, that does not mean you change all of society to confuse young people as to what is male and female, just because someone doesn't have it very clear in their understanding. A lot of these laws, I think, are just meant to pretty much be an assault upon Christian values, because Christians, frankly, you guys are in the way of progress in the area of the social engineering that these elite want to do. You don't believe this? Well, more and more in our universities. University of Delaware, article just this last week that was challenging them on their requirement that students undergo an ideological re-education. It's almost like the propaganda that Hitler put up and the sign when you go and you see those prisoner camps and they throw the Jews in and they throw them in the ovens. They had the sign, you know, in German, "Work shall set you free." And it was a lie, like everything else in Nazi Germany. They were not going to get free by work. And it's a lie what society is telling us about what is right and wrong. Especially that these students now have to fall in line. In the residence halls, there's this program, essentially, that the university's materials are used as, quote-unquote, listen, treatment, because the students are sick. They've come out of this parenting by Christians, and they need to be re-educated. I learned that when I was in college back in the late 70s. One of the professors basically said, listen, I want you to just chuck all that you've ever learned by your parents. It's all bunk. It's all garbage. You know, we're going to start fresh, and we're going to teach you what is right. And of course, they said, we're going to teach you how to think, but that was just a code word for we're going to teach you what we think and what you should think and everybody should think. In this University of Delaware's life residence program, they live in this dorm and they're required to attend training sessions to desensitize themselves in all kinds of ways, from social forms, the politics, race, sexuality, moral philosophy. Essentially, this is how you are to think, this is what you will think, and you will come along with this, and you will put up stuff on your dormitory door to identify with this, because this is what is going to be acceptable and what is not. This kind of forced behavior is like, I mean, they're actually coming out very bold with this program. Most of the universities are doing it much more subtly. But they're coming under fire, and they'll probably back off because now that it's public. But this is the world we live in. Should we be surprised? Of course, the tantalizing part about that re-education is, while they give you all this stuff to ponder against all of your Christian values, they at the same time dangle in front of you the carrot of sexual freedom. You can do whatever you like. There's no law. There's no rule. There's no right and wrong. And of course, that is very appealing to young people who are not very grounded in their faith, not very centered, and like all those there out in the plain of Dura, bowing to this idol, everybody, except Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, the king was very gracious to give him this opportunity, but I want you to notice their response in verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king." I like that, you know. The party poopers that they are. I mean, think about it. Their whole big celebration has been brought to a shocking standstill as they're confronting the king. And the king is expecting there's a misunderstanding here. Of course, you're going to bow. And all of a sudden, he hears them say, "We don't even need to answer you on this." If that's the case, if it's the furnace choice or bowing to the idol, we're not worried about it. God can deliver us from your hand and will deliver us from your hand. Whether through the fire or out of the fire, we believe. But I love their faith expressed even this way. "But if not," I think that was the best part of the confession of faith. that so often people that confess they're believers in God and they have this great faith would never say, because they think that would be a lack of faith. No, I think it's a wonderful faith. You know, their mind is made up. Hey, if I die, if I live, doesn't matter. Our God is able to deliver and will deliver. But if not, let it be known to you, O King, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Now let's get practical for a moment. Put yourself in their shoes. Imagine, you know, before this thing all unfolds and you're being brought to the king, some of the counselors of the king are saying to you, now guys, listen, you know, we know how you are very convinced about your God, and we don't want to damage that. That's cool. That's wonderful. Believe what you want to believe. But, you know, it's perceived that you're rebelling against the king. And just understand, I mean, if you don't give in, what is it going to benefit you? How can you be a benefit in the future? Better to bow right now. We know that you're only bowing in body. You can preserve your faith in your God, but you'll make the king happy. And then because the king will be happy, you'll have a lot more opportunities to talk to others about your God. But if you're dead, you have no more opportunity to tell people about your wonderful God. I mean, think of the subtlety of how it could be rationalized. And folks, this is how it was rationalized in Nazi Germany. This is how it was rationalized throughout many countries. This, listen, this is how it's rationalized in our own lives personally when we face the choice, sin or pleasure. If we sin against God for pleasure, you see that the whole point is, what is it prevents you from? This is what really kept these men from bowing. They knew very clearly the scriptures. They knew God was sovereign, that he said, worship no other gods, and they were taking it very literally. I am not going to dishonor God by bowing to a God that is not God. And they refused to bow. But what of us? How easily can we be convinced about our, well, you know, it's wonderful that you believe in Jesus. But you know, other people believe in all kinds of different things, and you need to be gracious and not intolerant. And certainly acknowledge that what they believe. And I've seen people waffle, even Christian leaders on television waffle on this issue. What about those who don't believe in Jesus? What will happen? Jesus is the one who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. It is a very real kindness that you give by letting the world know this is the way that God has provided for escape. All other trusts will end in destruction. By the way, all other religions are based on one premise, something that you do, some work that you perform, some ritual you do, some thing that is in you to reach up to God, where Christianity is the one thing that says, no, God does it all for you. You must believe wholeheartedly and only in what he has done for you, for he will not accept any boasting of anybody's ability. Look at me, what I have done to honor God. It's by grace. People can rationalize any sin. Hey, you know, we can sleep together. We're going to get married someday anyway. And well, God knows that. We're already married in God's eyes. If we love each other, we're already married. Hey, those embryos, they're just blobs of tissue. Abortion isn't really taking a life. And we're not really sure about these things. And this embryonic stem cell research, it's nothing bad. Just think of all the lives it might save. Now, Pastor, you're getting pretty political here. Well, I'm speaking of issues that I think are very pertinent to the church. And I think when we go to the polls and we make a decision, we need to make a decision based on what our Christian values are. And if you believe that the taking of an unborn life is killing a human life, if you believe that there's adult stem cell research that's proven wonderful, all these kinds of diseases are being cured by this research. It's amazing. Embryonic stem cell research has come up with zero cures at this point. But they promise, they say, oh, it's going to be wonderful. In the meantime, we're basically manufacturing these little fetuses and then destroying them in the process. We're making life to kill it. And I think the culture of death is becoming more and more prevalent. And that, folks, is why people left nations to come to this country. Because they knew if they believed a certain way, they wouldn't be killed. But now there is a group of people in this world, some 1.5 million a year are slaughtered on the altar of Molech, the god of pleasure, the unborn. No one's speaking up for them. And now they want to experiment with them in this state. What are you going to do? Now, if you believe it's not taking of a life, then by all means, vote for the research. But if you believe it is taking a life, then you've got to make your mind up. What are you going to do? You've got to choose who you are, what you believe. Well, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew what was right. They put their lives in the line, and they did not give in to the sin. In this open challenge of God, they stand strong. And I believe, you know, from the standpoint of what our obedience is to the state, it's very clear. The Bible says, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. Hitler used this passage in Romans chapter 13 to try to get the people in line. You've got to obey the state. Obey the state because the state is equal to God. But the very logic of this is that God is the one that ordained. Every authority comes from God. So therefore, if they now go against what God says, which is your allegiance to? This is where we have to be conscientious objectors. The day that the laws of this nation enforce me to sin against God will be the day that I will disobey those laws, because there is a higher law, and suffer the consequences most likely for that disobedience to the laws that men enact. But in the end, God will vindicate me. You know, here's the thing. Nebuchadnezzar, when he hears this statement, he's really ticked off. Verse 19, he can't believe his ears. He's the most powerful man in the world. He's given these guys this gracious opportunity to recant. And like Polycarp and many other martyrs who were forced by the state church religion back in the Dark Ages to recant of their belief in the Bible as the supreme authority, and to produce the Bible in other languages so other people could learn it in their own language, they basically stood their ground and were burned at the stake, killed in many other ways. No need to answer you. Our God is able to take care of this. Their bold defiance. They're not going to bow before this image. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's in a rage now. It says, full of fury, the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was actually heated. I have a tendency to think here that maybe something in the back of Nebuchadnezzar's mind was, you know, these Jewish guys, they've got some power, and maybe they're ready for this fire. Maybe they've got some magic incantation that'll preserve them. Well, I'm going to make sure they don't. Yeah, 7 times hotter. I thank Nebuchadnezzar for doing that, actually. You see, this is really what's happening. He commands the mighty men of valor in the army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, cast them into the burning fiery furnace. And these men were bound. Now, I want you to notice something. The word bind, bound, bound, bound. Let's count it as we're going through this. He was commanded in his army to bind them. These men were bound in their coats, their trousers, turbans, and their outer garments, cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And the king, Nebuchadnezzar, was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast 3 men bound into the midst of the fire? Bound, bound, bound. And then he says, they answered and said to the king, true, O king. And he says, look, he answered, I see 4 men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the 4th is like the Son of God. You know, this is what the world will do. You're bound, you're bound, you're bound. But when the Lord gets a hold of you, you're going to be loosed. And when you see that, it's like it hits you. The language here, the expression. But now Nebuchadnezzar is like freaking out. I would have loved to be in that furnace with the Lord at this point. He sees Jesus. Now he doesn't know it's Jesus. Calls it, the sky looks like the Son of God. It's amazing he uses that terminology, because he would have no clue that he actually indeed was the Son of the living God, the only begotten Son of the living God. This is a Christophany, the appearance of Christ in the Old Testament, in a few different places. There in Gideon with his parents, to Abraham, you have a number of different places where the Lord appears. Because, of course, he's eternal. He's outside of time. And here he is appearing here, and these guys are in the fire, walking around, I would imagine they're like excited. Man, this is cool. Talking to Jesus. And I would imagine they couldn't take their eyes off Jesus, but I can just imagine. Maybe this is just my thoughts on things, but Jesus is encouraging these guys. Guys, good job. Good job. Way to hang in there. You see, because I actually was looking for an opportunity to show power, and you guys gave me that opportunity. And man, Shadi, Meshach, Abednego, yeah, of course he would have called them by their Hebrew names, Hananiah, Mishael. He says, if you could just see the King Nebuchadnezzar's face right now. Don't look. I don't want you to turn around. Just take my word for it. It's amazing. I would just think how cool it would have been to be there. So Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. I'm sure the Lord said, go ahead. I'll see you guys on the other side. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the midst of the fire. I don't think they wanted to. This is too cool. Can we spend a few more moments in here? Well, the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the king's counselors gathered together. They saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. Now, when he drew near to the fire to tell them, I'm sure he felt the heat. And so to see them come out unscathed, it says the hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. They didn't even smell like smoke. Well, here Nebuchadnezzar humbles himself, finally. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces. Well, he's always wanting to cut somebody in. Somebody's got to be cut up. And their houses shall be made an ash heap, a dunghill, or I say outhouse, because that's what the term is, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. I mean, he's like, I mean, you know, think about it. This is like a little bit out of the ordinary, wouldn't you say? As the British would say, understating it. It was quite extraordinary, the situation. Well, the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. The resolve of these three men gave an opportunity for God to show his power. But I want you to, in conclusion, to think of this one thing. Who was it that gathered them together in the plain of Dura? The Bible says Nebuchadnezzar did. I submit to you that God drew them into the plain of Dura. That he allowed Nebuchadnezzar to have his heart lifted up and to make this golden image and to have this situation that threatens the lives of those who would not fall in line. Just as he is going to do again. He is going to gather people into the plain of Dura, so to speak. The world is going to have its opportunity with their technology and the power of those people in charge to reform this world for a whole new world order. And you will fall in line with it, or you will suffer the consequence. And they're going to be drawing us into the plain. It is God who is drawing us into the plain, folks. It's God who drew them there so that he could show his power. And indeed he will, as the whole world will be gathered against him in the tribulation period. And then the Lord will show up and they will see who is God. It's showdown. Folks, right now we're getting prepared for the showdown. Question is, where's your resolve? Where do you stand? Do you think it's strange that it's getting harder to be a Christian? To do the right thing? Don't be surprised by that. Do you think it's strange that it's hard to stand up for what is right? I mean, the world's pulling us here, the pressure of our own flesh here, and Satan is working on both of them to get us to fall, to do wrong, to justify it, rationalize it, blend us all together and that there's no real distinction of what we believe and what anyone else believes. I believe that the furnace just provides the opportunity for your faith to be seen. Otherwise, they wouldn't see it. Were it not for him calling them, everyone in the plain there to worship this image, they would have never encountered this God who delivered in such an amazing way. So next time you're fighting God with why you're working in this very godless environment, and they don't like Christians so much, and they're trying to get us in their little programs to re-educate us, to rethink about homosexuality and about, you know, cross-cult dressing and all the other perversions in the world. And they're going to make us think, oh, this is normal. Well, I have children that are falling in this lifestyle and I love them, but I don't agree with them. How do I respond to that? Well, those are the challenges. You know, we love people, even if they're sinners and they're going in the wrong direction, but we love them enough to tell them the truth. without hating them, without hurting them, but speaking the truth in love. But, you know, I think what happens is we are afraid that we'll be out of step with the rest of the culture, and the pressure to conform is so strong. You got to know who you are. Because when you leave here and you go out, you can very easily forget who you are in Christ. Forget what He has done for you. And I encourage you and challenge you. Be willing to take that stand for what is right and wrong in a loving, gracious manner, but take the stand nonetheless. Be willing to let your voice be heard in the polls, as well as calling your representatives, letting them know how you think. But that's just a small part of your, that's your citizenship here. Your citizenship in heaven now leads you to love people as Jesus loved. To lay your life down. You're not thinking of yourself. You're not worried about what other people have. You're content with where the Lord's put you because you believe He's putting you in this place right now for such a time that He will use you. You've got to trust Him. Every single individual here, every person hearing on the radio, hearing on the internet, the Lord God is on the throne in such majesty and power such as you can't even imagine. And He is not going to scare the primitives with His dazzling brightness, as He very easily could and cause them all to fall before Him out of fear. He would rather have you live in such a way that compels people to want to follow Him out of love. This is what our Lord is all about. God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him would not perish but have everlasting life. That God was the one who saw we were sinners and that we couldn't help ourselves no matter what we tried. We failed to meet the standard. So He sent His only begotten Son into the world to die in our place, to pay the penalty for our sin with His own blood. And as many as received Him, to them He gave the power to become His children. Come to Me, Jesus said, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in Me will never die, and he who lives and dies will live again. Understand this truth. Jesus is the door into the sheepfold. There is no other way to get to the Father but through Him. And we not only need to be settled in our own minds with this truth, but we need to be willing to speak this truth in love to the world. And if you're not a goer, to be a sender, to support those who are going, the missionaries, to support the outreaches and the ways that the word can get forth. Sometimes people, God gives those gifts and abilities to be behind the scenes. But in every case, all of us have opportunities with individuals the Lord puts in our path to be that witness. Not obnoxiously, but at the same time, in truth, to stand your ground. And who knows what kind of effective door the Lord might open. For these guys, it was quite effective, wasn't it? Didn't seem like a door. Hey, we're going to go be thrown in the fire today. But God works it out. Maybe you feel that way. That's okay. I'd rather be in the fire with the Lord than hanging outside the fire, sipping martinis with King Nebuchadnezzar, because you know how it ends.